Session number 12389, E. Spiegelberg, Reel 1.
Eldora Spiegelberg, Reel 1. So if I could ask you then, first of all, Eldora, you know, about your background, the sort of family and upbringing, really trying to find out the basis of your pacifism.
Yes, I was born into a missionary family in Bulgaria, and my grandparents had already gone there in 1852. My father was born there and became an ordained minister in the States, and then returned as a young man with his first wife, both of them graduates of Oberlin College. And he then met my mother, who was Swiss, after the death of his first wife, and married her. And all of us were born either in Bulgaria or in Greece or Macedonia. And so we had a long history of interest in religion, and my father was not a pacifist at first. He was very proud of being an American, and he believed that the First World War was actually being fought to save democracy and to end all future wars. But when the terrible Peace of Versailles was reached and he saw how the victors were slapping these reparations on Germany and the other vanquished countries, he joined the Fellowship of Reconciliation as a founding member and became an absolute pacifist. And so in our family, we heard a great deal about heroes like Albert Schweitzer and various great peacemakers, especially Gandhi, in whose career my father was very, very interested. He subscribed to Young India, I think was Gandhi's publication, and I remember even as a teenager, my father reading aloud Gandhi's autobiography, My Experiments with Truth. And so we believed from the very start that war was wrong and could never actually solve problems and only created worse problems. So that's the background that I come from, and I didn't do a great deal about it. And I came back to the States to go to college when I was 18 years old, and went to Beloit College in Wisconsin for 4 years, and then got my master's degree at Oberlin in psychology. And during those years, I was very opposed to war mongering. Few students who had lived in Europe knew that another war was coming. We were very sure of it. And all the students said, oh no, you know, there's never going to be another war. They didn't believe us, and we felt fairly isolated because of this. And at Oberlin, the year after I left Beloit, I found a great deal of resonance because a whole group of students had gone to Spain in the brigade there. I've forgotten what it was called. Was it the Karl Marx Brigade or something like that? And they wrote back a great deal to the campus, and we Actually, I was active in putting on a simulated day of as if war had been declared, and the president of Oberlin, Wilkinson, cooperated, and it was a very exciting day in which the whole community acted as if war had been declared and what the various components would have done if it had been. So then I went to Pittsburgh and trained as a teacher of the deaf, and there my first actual participation in something of this pacifist nature was, I guess, the joining in a demonstration in solidarity with the folks who were trying to get freedom for India. And we marched, and I was very surprised that a matron from a rather affluent part of Pittsburgh was walking beside me, and I asked her if she had done this kind of thing before, and she said, "Oh, yes, we used to march all the time for women's suffrage with Jane Addams of Hull House," and she said, "I'm used to taking part in this kind of demonstrations." So that I had heard about the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, but had not had anything much to do with it, except that a group of young people who opposed the idea of the United States entering into the Second World War used to meet in their headquarters. I guess I should say that by this time the Second World War had started, and we felt that it would be better if the United States would stay out of it, and Roosevelt, of course, was trying very hard to get us involved because of his tremendous interest in saving Great Britain, which, of course, we also were very eager to do, but I guess as pacifists, we felt that that wasn't the way to go. And, of course, just right at that time, on the 7th of December 1941, when the attack on Pearl Harbor occurred, that very day we were demonstrating and passing out leaflets in the streets against joining the war. And that quickly had to end because, of course, war was declared on Japan, and we were very much very isolated in our viewpoint, and we called ourselves then Americans for Democracy, and not against war as we had before. And so I went on with this until my marriage in 1944, when I went to a little town in Wisconsin called Appleton, and there I lived for about 18 years, and our two daughters were born. My husband was a professor of philosophy at Lawrence College, now Lawrence University, and at that time, my pacifism manifested itself mostly in working for refugees and helping displaced persons to come to the United States after the war. I was very, very moved when a year after the atom bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the New Yorker magazine devoted its entire issue to a report about five Japanese and what happened to them during the bombing. I think it was Hershey who wrote this report, because he did another one years afterwards and followed them up and saw what happened to them later. Well, since the bomb had fallen just a month before the birth of our first daughter, it made a great impression on me, and I really wanted to somehow do something to see that this kind of thing never would happen again. And my opportunity arose when we moved to St. Louis in 1963, and a committee of young people decided that they would initiate an observance on August 6th for the Hiroshima bombing. And I worked with them, but I went to Europe that year, so I didn't actually participate. And it was maybe a couple of years later that somehow or other it seemed to devolve on me to initiate these observances every year, which I did because no one seemed to be really concerned with what might happen if there were a nuclear war. They just kind of swept it under the rug and went on with their own lives. And only once a year, when we would have this observance, would there perhaps be an article or two in the newspapers and maybe a photograph if we were lucky. But we usually had very small audiences and very small participation.
What did you actually do for this observance?
Oh, we always had banners. We always handed out leaflets. We usually had it in a different place of worship, either a synagogue or a church. And finally, on the, I think it was the 30th anniversary, we held it in Forest Park, which is a big park that we have. And one of the hibakusha, the survivors, an elderly Methodist minister, came and was our speaker. And it was a very moving observance. And the most striking observance that we ever had was one in which we vigiled all night at a site near St. Louis University, where a building had been demolished, so it looked like Hiroshima after the bomb. And we read readings every hour, and we folded paper cranes to keep ourselves awake, and then stood in a circle at dawn and remembered what had happened. And then 2 hours later, many of us went into churches, and the ministers had agreed to talk about it from their pulpits and to give out paper cranes to the audiences as they left the church and so on. So we did many things to commemorate, and we're still doing them.
What sort of reaction did you and do you get, Eldora, you know, from the public of St. Louis?
Well, it just depended. Some rowdies would drive by and shout, "What about Pearl Harbor?" And or they'd shout, "Bomb them to hell again," or things like that, terrible things. On the whole, people were sympathetic and interested. But the Japanese community, which is quite large here, absolutely refuses to have anything to do with it because they don't want to seem to be criticizing the United States. And we don't. We try to emphasize worldwide efforts to make nuclear war impossible. We don't blame the United States and so on, but the Japanese are very sensitive about this. So it is, there's a very mixed reaction. But of course, when St. Louis became the national headquarters for the nuclear freeze movement in 1981, everything changed. We had a rather huge movement here, and there was a real hope that we might actually be able to freeze the arms race. We responded to the call to stop the arms race by Forsberg, and we had a very active committee here and the national committee, so that we had every year a rather large national convention in St. Louis, and from that also came a Mississippi peace tour, which resembled the Volga River peace tours, and for two consecutive years there were 50 Soviets and 50 Americans on these tours on the Mississippi, and they happened to coincide with the Hiroshima date, so that we combined them very, very impressively. And these got a great deal of publicity. So after that, the freeze movement pretty much took over the observance every year. And I was always involved in the committee because I'm on the board of the freeze, but didn't feel that I had to sort of start everything from scratch by myself every year. And
With the various sort of moves for disarmament which have occurred, do you think your committee and the, you know, what happened in St. Louis with your group, do you think that had an effect on what happened, you know, a small effect?
Well, we like to think that the peace movement, not just here but throughout the United States, played a large role in ending the Vietnam War, and that's what we do take credit for, because it was our group, of course, in every city, which would mobilize the large busloads of people who would go to Washington by the thousands and demonstrate against the Vietnam War. That's where I started to do that, much against my family's will, but they finally all acquiesced in my periodically going on these bus trips to Washington. They were pretty strenuous because we would drive all night, demonstrate during the day, get back on the buses and drive back all night. I was lucky because I could always sleep on the bus, but many people couldn't.
Once you got to Washington, how easy was it to sort of demonstrate in the places you wanted to? I was wondering, for instance, how you would have been treated by, say, the police and the authorities there.
Oh, well, it varied. I mean, there are numerous pictures of police with their bayonets pointed towards the marchers, and the flower children putting flowers on the ends of their bayonets and so on. And of course, we surrounded the Pentagon, and sometimes one large group would be committed to civil disobedience before the march, while the rest would not be, but that would always get a lot of attention. The police were rather hostile. I think they were frightened because it was an overwhelming number of people who went there each time. And we would move in our thousands along Constitution Avenue and the mall, and it was just, I think that as the war wore on, that the police became more friendly, and of course, finally, the war was ended, and I just can't believe that it wasn't largely due to this great expression of protest by millions throughout the country, where just thousands were able to reach Washington. But that period was the very height of the peace movement's activity. Our own branch of Women's International League gained more members at that time than we ever had before. And it's dropped off again since the Vietnam War because people go back to their daily preoccupations and we cannot make them feel that working for the test ban, nuclear test ban, and for disarmament, total nuclear disarmament by the year 2000, which is our Women's International League goal and so on, that these things are as urgent as ending that terrible war. Of course, now the war in the Persian Gulf had somewhat the same effect.
Yes. If I could ask you about that a bit later, because it's very interesting for us, you know, to hear about the Vietnam War and the impact of the peace movement. This, of course, was a long war, wasn't it? About, was it 10 years?
Yes.
It lasted, yes. Did you find, you know, how soon were you able to mobilize people against it, do you think? After the start of that war, you know, were you, for instance, very active right from the word go when the war started?
I don't think we realized that war was on for a while. We simply didn't know that all our so-called advisors who were pouring into Vietnam were actually becoming a military, large military force, and we were supposedly always simply advising South Vietnam and helping them against a communist force in the north. And the communist threat was constantly held up as the reason that we needed to be there, because there was the domino theory that if Vietnam fell, then there would be no cushion against communist China, et cetera, et cetera. And it took a while till all the peace movement realized that this was a massive, massive mobilization, and of course then the draft was instituted, and that reached into every household. And with that, we had something that we could actually work against in every community. We formed a peace information center here. It was a storefront, and a young man came in a constant stream to find out how they could avoid going to war. Some of them, how they could go to Sweden or to Canada or underground. We didn't advise them on any illegal actions, but we gave them a lot of information, and we collected the information from every religious body as to its theological teachings about war, so that these young men would have some backing if they happened to have a religious preference and so on. So we were very active at that time, and many of us were counselors there in the center, and we passed out literature constantly, and we were surveilled by the FBI all the time. Some of us we know have large FBI dossiers. Yvonne Logan, who has been both a national president of Women's International League and local president several times, had a huge compilation of every talk that she ever gave anywhere. She was able to get hers through the Freedom of Information Act. I tried to get mine, but I gave up somewhere along the line.
What was it about that war that the American people, you know, protested so against it? What was the nature of the Vietnam War?
It was so obvious that it had nothing to do with our own security. We had no business in that part of the world, that we were throwing Vietnam into the arms of the communists rather than protecting them from the communists, because we knew that Ho Chi Minh was actually a very democratic person and had, as I remember, fashioned the Constitution of Vietnam according to the American Constitution, and that they were, our State Department was simply turning these people into symbolic hate figures that in order to make it possible to fight that war. And we also felt that it was terribly racist that if these had not been Asians, there would have been a lot more protest against bombing them as we did. And we were just devastated, those of us in the peace movement, by the things that we heard. We sent a delegation from Women's International League to North Vietnam, and they made peace, a separate peace with the women of North and South Vietnam. And we, from the very beginning, as you know, the Quakers, too, had a center there where they built prostheses for Vietnamese who had lost limbs in the war. And the Quakers were very active there in trying to bring about peace also. So the whole thing went against everything that we believed in, and it was just the dreadful things that were done, like pouring trying to completely destroy the forests and trying to save the villages by burning them, and the dreadful saturation bombing, and the sheer courage of the Vietnamese and not giving up made us very sympathetic towards them. I mean, here was this huge American war machine vented against this small, rather rural country, and yet they prevailed, and we just admired them.